About a year or so ago, I started thinking about buying another espresso machine. The one I had lasted me a couple years in it. It was extremely, well, it wasn't really even what you'd call entry level. It's kind of more like budget El Cheapo model. And it was difficult to use and was not made very well, and it was hard to steam milk or do much with it. So I thought, this is kind of an interest of mine. Maybe it would make sense to spend a little money and get kind of an entry-level machine. Maybe I should upgrade. So I started doing some exploring, doing some research about this, and joined an online forum that discusses espresso and learned, well, there are a lot of options out there. And I also learned that it can become a very expensive hobby. Not just the machine, but the grinder and the scale and the tampers and the baskets and the bottomless portafilters and knock boxes and everything. People spend thousands of dollars on this hobby. Some of them will argue that they're actually saving money over time, because if you make your drink at home instead of buying it at a coffee shop, you're actually saving money, most likely. And so if you do that often enough, this is going to pay for itself eventually. This sometimes turns into a joke, and they'll say, "Yeah, only another 34,000 drinks, and I'll have paid for this machine." One of the problems is that a common disease sets in, and they're aware of it, and they have a name for it. They call it upgrade-itis. It's when you've bought a machine that you're happy with to start with, but as you watch other people and see new options coming out, new machines coming out, and people reviewing these machines, and sure enough, yeah, there's some advantages to this other one. Can steam milk faster, or maybe it heats up faster. It's just easier to use or more accurate or whatever. And pretty soon, the machine you bought, you start looking at it kind of askance and wishing that you had spent a little more money. And as if you continue down that road, eventually you end up upgrading. People go from contented to discontented. And they upgrade, and then they need to even drink more coffee to make the math work. So contentment is what I want to talk about. It's hard. It's hard to be contented. It's something I struggle with. So, and I wanted to share about this subject for a while now, and I thought Thanksgiving maybe would be a good time to talk about this. So yeah, we daydream about better situations, better things, upgrades, becoming better at something, more skilled at something, becoming more fit, a bigger kitchen would be nice. More land is always nice. What if you had some woods, and a creek would be so nice. A zero-turn mower, if you've used the school's mower, you may struggle with contentment. It's nice. These things are good. These things can be good. They can be good. Some of these upgrades make sense, and we should consider some of them, but they won't actually make us contented people. I think in the back of our heads, we kind of know that. What does the Bible say about contentment? Well, the New Testament doesn't use the word contentment a whole lot. There are a few examples. And each of them that I find are connected in one way or another with what God has to offer. So this verse up here on the board, thanks, Wendy, for getting it up on the board. Wendy knows I'm not going to come up with a verse for the board. I think by now she took care of it, and this is the perfect verse. So it says, "Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I'll never leave you or forsake you." So even without all the things, there's a contentment that can be found in God. Another verse that you're probably thinking of is the one in Philippians 4. I have learned, Paul says, I've learned in whatever situation I'm in to be content. And then he says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. So that even in lean times, we should be able to find contentment in what God has to offer. He's our source of strength. In 1 Timothy 6, godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. And he says some other things and goes on to urge Timothy to fight the good fight of faith and lay hold on eternal life. Through God, we have eternal life. And what compares to that, really? So what these scriptures remind us is that God is the real source of contentment. He is a source of rest and satisfaction. Without him, something major is always going to be missing. And I think the ungodly people can sense this sometimes. And I think even Christians, when things aren't the way they ought to be, I feel like we can sense that too. Without God, something's missing. So I'm going to read this quote. I got this from this book, Mission Drift. It's a good book. In this one chapter, he talks about an interview that Brad Pitt had with Rolling Stone magazine back in 1999. So Brad Pitt is some kind of amazing actor and celebrity and movie star and so on, all right? And he was talking about the shortcomings of the world's definition of success and the rise of secularism. And he says, we're headed for a dead end, a numbing of the soul, complete atrophy of the spiritual being. And so the reporter of Rolling Stone asked him, so if we're headed toward this kind of existential dead end in society, what do you think should happen? And Pitt replied, now I don't know what he would say today. This is 1999. He said, hey man, I don't have those answers yet. The emphasis now is on success and personal gain. I'm sitting in it, and I'm telling you, that's not it. I'm the guy who's got everything. I know, but I'm telling you, once you get everything, then you're just left with yourself. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. It doesn't help you sleep any better. You don't wake up any better because of it. Now, no one's going to want to hear that. I understand it. I'm sorry. I'm the guy who's got to say it, but I'm telling you. There's something missing when people don't have God. Something really crucial is wrong. So if I'm... maybe I won't use that. I want to use mushrooms here just for a second for a quick illustration. So if I'm lost somewhere in the wilderness, and I'm starving, suffering from malnutrition, and I stumble across a patch of mushrooms, let's say these guys, I may have to do some cleanup up here afterward, okay? So I like mushrooms. But if you're starving and you're lost and you're hungry and you find a patch of mushrooms, you may feel like you've been saved. This is the solution. I mean, if it's a big enough patch, right? And this is the answer. You know, I can survive off of this. The problem is these guys, you could stuff yourself with them and not be, yeah, maybe a little better off. And you may be satisfied for a little while, but it's not going to last very long. These guys are about 3 calories per mushroom, 3.5 maybe. You eat 10 of these, 30 calories. I mean, how many mushrooms is it going to take to stay alive? Quite a few. And it would be a mistake to to stop searching for a real source of nutrition. Even acorns would be better if you could boil them. It'd be a mistake to start looking for something else, to stop looking for something else and just, you know, camp at the mushroom patch. This is not the answer. They're mushrooms. They're delicious, but, you know, you would not want to make a Thanksgiving meal out of this. They're not satisfying. And by the way, you youngsters, Elise and Cedric and everyone, you young guys, if you find mushrooms in the woods, don't eat them. Not unless your parents can tell you they're safe, because a lot of them are poisonous. These, I picked these at Walmart, so I know they're safe. Okay, so let's talk about contentment and the contentment that can be found in God. That's where it's at. And I should say a clarification up front. When I talk about a person who's contented, I'm not talking about someone who is just okay with everything that's going on. Everything's wonderful. Everything's good. And they're happy all the time because everything's wonderful. That's not what I'm talking about, because there are things we should be discontented about and unhappy about and bothered by. Their kingdom concerns. How am I doing as a father? Are my children learning to know God, reaching the lost, relationships, things like that? These things matter, and those are things it's okay to be concerned about and discontented about. Not talking about that kind of contentment. I'm talking about a contentment that we feel inside that is a rest and a satisfaction that comes from living with God, knowing we belong to him and that we're where we ought to be, where he wants us to be. So I'm going to look at three different passages here that relate to finding contentment in God. The first one comes in Luke chapter 10. So please turn there. So this is the scene of Martha and Mary, verses 38 through 42. And this scene is, I really enjoy it. It's authentic, it's relatable, and it's funny. It's kind of an everyday encounter, but someone obviously thought it was important enough to record this, to tell it to Luke, to get it recorded in the Gospel of Luke. Luke heard about it one way or another, and Luke thought it was important. I think it's important. This scene, I think, says a lot about finding contentment in this life. So Martha's busy, Mary is sitting, and this seems to happen a lot. When one person is busy and someone else is sitting, the busy person gets annoyed. And it even extends to Jesus. Lord, do you not care? Martha says. Now it happened as they went that he entered a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she approached him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Therefore, tell her to help me. And Jesus answered and said to her, Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things, but one thing is needed. And Mary has chosen that good part, which will not be taken away from her. So Mary sat at Jesus' feet, but Martha was distracted. And that word distracted in the original and in the English contains the meaning of getting pulled away, distracted. It's the opposite of attracted, distracted. She was pulled away. So Martha maybe had some inclination to sit at the feet of Jesus, but she got pulled away with much serving, it says. And I don't know what all is included in that, but it feels like it must have been more than what was necessary. She got distracted and she got discontented. She wasn't happy. And her basic problem here is that the many things had crowded out the one thing. And I know what this is like. I know what it's like to get worried about many things and have them take me away from the feet of Jesus. Mary, on the other hand, probably was aware that there are things she could be doing, like straightening up or helping get the food out, or I don't know what all things they did in those days to be hosts. But she decided she's not doing any of that. This is my chance to sit here with Jesus, listen to him, and this is the best use of my time. Good decision, good choice. There's no replacement for spending time with Jesus. There's no, you can't take the place of Jesus. There's no person who can do that for you. There's no hobby or activity or anything that's going to take the place of Jesus. From the very beginning, we were made to have communion with God. You see that in the Garden of Eden. There's no replacement. So a contented person says, has come to the conclusion, one thing is needed. There's one thing that's really important. And again, I often go about my day or week thinking, it's not just one thing, it's more like 15 things. And that makes the one thing suffer. It's easy to get discontented and frustrated and feel unsettled when you've got a big list and you just aren't getting it all done. And you feel like these are things that should be done, but I can't get them all done. And it's frustrating, and then you get bent out of shape. But how important are they really? I mean, how important are some of these things? How often is everything done? Almost never. You know how Jesus said, the poor you will always have with you. I feel like that's how that could be said about a lot of things, other things that we can't get to, like dishes and laundry and the grass. You're always going to have something to do, plenty to do. It's not like these things don't matter at all, but they're not the one thing. They're not the one thing that's needed. And so I'm hoping that I can learn that as I focus on the one thing and remind myself that this is where it's at, this is what really matters. If I don't get to the other things, that doesn't have to be distressing. I was listening to a podcast recently where Merle Burkholder was being interviewed, and he was talking about busyness. It's a good podcast. And he said, it feels like to him that the more he has on his plate as a leader, the more responsibilities he has, the more time he needs to spend with God. The contented person says one thing is needed, and he doesn't get everything done. He does not get everything done that's on his list. Okay, the next passage I'd like to take you to is in Psalm 4. I feel like I could have picked probably a dozen different psalms that could have demonstrated this, but there's a connection between contentment and security, and we see this in this psalm. Psalm 27, Paul would definitely have that connection also. Now, in the Martha and Mary passage, Martha got worried and distracted and pulled away from the one thing that matters. Here in this passage, it feels to me like David is doing the opposite, and he's starting off distressed and coming to a place of contentment and rest. This is a psalm, maybe, for those of us who wake up in the middle of the night and worry about things. I don't know. I wonder if he maybe wrote this while he was awake at night and stressed out. Psalm 4. Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer. How long, O you sons of men, will you turn my glory to shame? How long will you love worthlessness and seek falsehood? Selah. But know that the Lord has set apart for himself him who is godly. The Lord will hear when I call to him. Be angry and do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. Selah. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. There are many who say, who will show us any good? Lord, lift up the light of your countenance upon us. You have put gladness in my heart more than in the season that their grain and wine increased. I will both lie down in peace and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. David seems to know how to go from a place of distress to a place of rest. And in this psalm, he tells us, don't, in your anger, don't sin, don't give in to frustration, but meditate on the fact that God is a deliverer, he's trustworthy, even when things are scary. You alone make me dwell in safety. And yes, maybe there are a lot of worthless men out there trying to cause trouble. Maybe a lot of things are going wrong these days, and it's just so much is messed up out there. Who's going to show us anything good? But David is reminded that you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. There's no other source of true security. This brings David back to a restful place, which takes me back to this verse. I will never leave you or forsake you, so we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me? Be content with what you've got in the Lord. Contentment is closely related to the idea of security, of course, because it's hard to be contented when you don't feel secure. And it's tempting to feel more secure because of things that we have, like money in the bank, or a good job, or living in a low-crime neighborhood. Those things can make us feel more secure. They're in our favor. It feels like we're better off. But if God alone makes me dwell in safety, then it's not actually true that those other things are making me safer. The national debt bothers me. You know, the fact that we're paying how many trillion dollars in interest. It's really, you know, disturbing, right? But it doesn't actually make me more secure if we're operating at a surplus. If the government's operating at a surplus and doesn't have any national debt, am I more secure? No, I'm not actually more secure. God's people aren't safer because a Republican was elected. This is not about Trump. We could be talking about Abraham Lincoln. God's people aren't safer because of who's in charge. There's no person who can make the church safer or more secure. David had this figured out from a young age. We see with his willingness to face Goliath, who was equipped and trained, and it wasn't even a fair competition. And this did not bother David. This did not upset him. He felt like he knew God was with him, and it didn't make a difference. Goliath could have been, it didn't make a difference. David found security and rest in knowing that God was with him, and he knows the Lord knows who are his, and he set apart the godly for himself. In Matthew 6, Jesus told us not to worry, And he said, don't worry about things like what shall we eat and what shall we drink and what are we going to wear. Those are the things that the Gentiles, and that means the ungodly, the people that don't have God, these are things they stress out about and pursue and seek after. And it kind of makes sense because we need those things. But God knows we need those things. And Jesus says, God knows this, you need them. But if you seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness, these things will be added to you. And the reason Jesus is wanting us not to worry, it's not just an end in itself. It's also it's because worry pulls us away from a singleness of loyalty, a singleness of I, as it says in the previous verses leading up to that. Worry will pull us away. They will distract us from what matters. So that those verses there in Matthew 6 tell me that if God's kingdom and his righteousness are our first concern, God will take care of your needs. And he knows what you need, and you're valuable to him. It reminds me a little bit of the situation of Elijah meeting the woman, the widow woman, who had one last meal. And he said, give that to me, and God will take care of you. And it feels kind of like there's a parallel there. And Jesus is saying, you worry about the kingdom, and God will worry about you. Now, my problem is, to be honest, that I've moved away. I've graduated from worrying about basic needs into worrying about things I don't need. And that's a struggle. So put the kingdom first and trust that God will take care of you. A contented person believes that God is the source of security. You alone make me dwell in safety. And it doesn't mean we should take unnecessary risks. If a tornado is coming, seek shelter. I think that makes sense. But we realize that true security comes from God, not things. Okay, the last passage I want to take you to is Psalm 1. So in the 1 Timothy passage that we think about a lot when we think about contentment and greed and materialism, 1 Timothy 6, right? That's the passage that says godliness with contentment is great gain. And Paul goes on to tell Timothy to flee these things that lead to greed and covetousness and pull us away from God. He says, flee these things and pursue righteousness and godliness and faith and love and patience and gentleness. And I think it's really important for us to realize that contentment is related to what we flee and what we pursue. This man here in Psalm 1, the man who is blessed and who delights in the law of the Lord, well, how did that become his delight? What was involved in that? How does he become so fruitful and I feel like contented? Let's read this together. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. The ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. So this blessed man is delighting in the law of the Lord, and this does not look like grim determination hanging in there, being good, not because he wants to, because he has to. And instead, he is deeply enjoying his experience with God. And he knows what to pursue and what to flee. I think it's really important for us to understand that appetites are a big player in this area of contentment. They're a big player. Okay, one last coffee analogy. I learned to enjoy drinking black coffee. When I was young, I started off drinking coffee with sugar and cream, of course. And it came out of the green Taster's Choice jar. Mom's was better. It came out of the red jar. But I drank it with sugar and cream, and of course, I enjoyed that. But at some point, I decided I would like to appreciate black coffee and enjoy it. I would like to, you know, because it really tastes what coffee's like. I would like to enjoy black coffee. Now, some coffee is so bad you might as well put in sugar and cream. But black coffee, I wanted to actually enjoy coffee black. So what that required was stopping putting in sugar and cream. You can't enjoy black coffee and keep on drinking sugar and cream with it all the time. It's just, you know, it washes out the flavor of coffee, and you're going to be attached to the sugar and cream, not so much the black coffee. So if you want to enjoy black coffee, you need to stop mixing in this other stuff with it, these additives. And as someone who wants to enjoy what God has to offer and delight in the Word and in godliness, can't be keep adding in other things that go against it. The things that Paul would say you should be fleeing. Contentment is related to what we flee and what we pursue. And if we pursue the wrong things, we won't be content. Mushrooms. If you pursue good and not so good at the same time, you won't be content. Don't expect to be contented in God while you're feeding something that's not good. And I've also learned that if something, I think this is mostly true, if it's not good and it's not bad, it's probably bad. You know, if it's not good and it's not bad, it's probably bad. Probably bad for you anyway. So in conclusion, a contented person, I'm not thinking of someone who is happy and bubbly and carefree and everything's wonderful. I'm thinking about someone who has found rest and satisfaction and peace in God. That person will say one thing is needed: living with Jesus, walking with Jesus. I'm not going to get everything done. That's okay if I'm doing well in the one thing area. A contented person says, "You alone are my source of security. I'm going to worry less about things and more about the kingdom." A contented person says, "This is my delight. This is what I'm going to delight in. I'm going to learn to love what God has to offer and not feed the things that take me away from God." One thing you'll notice those three passages had in common is that they all point to this idea of singleness of outlook, singleness of priorities, what the King James Version would call if your eye is single, it says in the King James Version, if you have a healthy, whole eye. And each of these passages speak to that idea. And the point is that the more single-minded we are in our focus in our life, the more contentment we will find. And when we're not single-minded and we're not seeking God first, we'll be dissatisfied, we'll be restless, we'll be looking around, because it will feel like some part of us will tell us something is missing, and we'll be right, but it won't be something that can be replaced by a hobby or a new house or a new espresso machine or anything like that. So let's learn to find contentment in God. Let's have a song.